Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. Happy Friday. This is Renee. Welcome back to Renee's Heart to Heart. Well, it's Friday, and we made it through another week with part of our government closed and the ups and downs of life, and we made it again. So there's a little bit of reason for celebration. I think every time you get up and everything is status quo, it's a go. Today is recap day. Today's the day that we go over all the things that we talked about all week. I think we had a couple of shows that we could probably expound on for many days. And they're all stories that never go away. Faces change and names change, but the stories are very similar all the time. I'm going to bring Shelley in so that we can recap together, because she often remembers things I didn't and vice versa. So, good morning, Shelley.
Good morning, Renee.
How are you?
This morning? I'm doing good.
I'm good. Yeah, me too. Me too. I got up pretty early this morning, and I was getting, well, the big kids get themselves ready, but of course AJ, I have to get his clothes out for him and all this kind of stuff, and he's, I went in the bedroom to wake him up, and he ran a marathon yesterday at school. Once a month they do a marathon, and it's a way for the school to make money, because we pledge how many times he can run around the track, you know. So he raised $30, and he ran around the track like 22 times. So, but he fell down on his second turn around the track. So he came home with a big Band-Aid on his knee and everything. So this morning we got up. So I had to find short shorts, which he doesn't normally like to wear because they all have to be below his knees. You know, they become fashion aficionados by the time they're five. You know that, right?
Of course.
And so I said, Grandma picked out shorter shorts so it wouldn't hit your knee. And he goes, oh, I guess I can wear these. I said, oh, pain wins out over fashion. You would never make a good woman. And he looked at me like, yeah, he looked at me like, I'm not sure what that means, but okay, Grandma. So it is a fun way to start your day with a seven-year-old. He's pretty funny in the morning. So it's Friday, and we're going to go over what we talked about all through the week. And, of course, Monday, our show was about all the stories I found about the chances people take when they're diagnosed with cancer, number one, and number two, when they survive cancer. We talked about all the women and men that become kind of daredevils and climb mountains and bungee cord jump and all the silly things that are out there for us to do for entertainment, none of which I have any interest in, by the way. But I don't know. I might feel differently if I had to overcome a major challenge and get myself to a place where I felt like I had really fought the fight and won, you know. So what did you think about Monday's stories? Do you know anybody like that, Shelley? We didn't talk about that. We did talk about a couple people that we knew from Hippocrates. But do you know anybody closer than guests and stuff like that that has overcome a big challenge like cancer and has done some strange things afterwards?
No, actually, the only couple of people I knew, the main way their life changed was that they became what I call high performers. It's like they felt this need to leverage every day to mean something. All of a sudden they became super productive and they sought things that were more meaningful, where, you know, if they had an office job that they were passionate about, they left that to go and do work that was more meaningful to them. So I can think of a couple of people that fit that role. And I know of somebody who had a near-death experience who was kind of lost and depressed, and from the near-death experience, and I don't know this individual personally, although I have met him, but his story is very well known. I've read his book and things like that. And after a near-death experience from a horrific car accident, that really nobody really understands how he survived, but he was hospitalized for a long time. He completely shifted the direction of his life and became a performer. So these two people that I'm thinking of, neither one of them went to the extreme, but it absolutely did impact how they moved forward with their life, in that they started doing things that were more meaningful, that they were more passionate about, they became more successful because of it, that kind of thing. Because they had a different mindset. They said, all right, I have a second chance here. I've got to really make a chance. You know, instead of working for 20 years and waiting for that opportunity to arrive, they sort of brought the opportunity in now, because they felt that sense of urgency because they were so close to not being with us anymore.
So their near-death experience made them grateful to be alive.
Right, right.
And they didn't see the need to, face destiny and say, ha-ha, you didn't get me, so look what I can do, and things like that. I think
If anything, it made them more protective, which is interesting. We didn't talk about this, but these are the only two real life people that I know that were that close. And I know a third person who went with the same route. Also, it is somebody that I met. I'm not personal friends with them, but I met them in real life. I shook their hand. I spoke to them for a few minutes. It's one of the lectures I'd seen. And he actually had three near-death experiences, which is extremely unusual for one person. But he was hit by lightning once, and I forgot what the other two incidences are, but he's actually where he was pronounced dead at the hospital, that type of thing. And he lives a very different life now. He quit his corporate job. He went into the lecture circuit. He started researching what happened to him. And how to heal his body. The first time he almost died from an illness, and then he had two other, like an accident or something like that. But because of that, those profound experiences, he developed a huge, huge respect for life, for what our physical bodies can withstand and recover from, because at one point he was terribly, terribly ill. And so again, here you have a couple of examples of people that don't go to that extreme, but definitely change them. It didn't make them daredevils or want to jump out of airplanes, although there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not saying that.
Right.
That's something that you and I have in common that I don't think either one of us have any desire to do. But these three people that I know, what it did is it made them want to be higher performers. It made them want to do more with each day because they felt they were being given a second chance to do something with their lives. They looked at it that way.
Well, and that to me is the most, that makes the most sense to me. And again, I'm not downgrading other people's reaction to an experience like that at all, because of course you never know how you're going to act. You can imagine, suppose, think that you're going to be one way, and then when something like that really happens, sometimes you're just the opposite. So I think that I understand both things, I guess. I get why you would want to make the most out of life now. I also understand why you would want to, push it. Maybe it has to do with the adrenaline. Maybe it has to do with the rush of, you know, for some people, achieving means overcoming, fighting a fear. Remember when we did the trapeze at the Institute?
Yes, Yes, excellent example. Yes.
The whole idea, folks, of the trapeze was for people who were fighting for their lives in some cases, maybe not fighting for their lives, but fighting to have a better life, a better quality of life, a healthier, more active life than what they have gotten themselves to with sometimes what life throws at you and sometimes poor choices. And mm-hmm. if they do the trapeze, it would help them overcome fear. And
right.
I had never thought about it until we met this young man. His name was Peter. And his mother, who was one of our guests at the Institute. But I often think about the fact that my grandson that got hurt did the trapeze before this happened to him. And I never made any kind of correlation to it, but he certainly fought the fight of somebody incredibly brave and strong. And maybe that had something to do with it. I don't know.
Well, the trapeze is interesting because it does two things. It, number one, it helps people face their fears because it's fear of heights, fear of letting go, because the whole point of the trapeze is that you're swinging across, but at some point you have to let go of the rings you're holding and put your hands out to catch the rings of the individual that's catching you. So the two parts of the trapeze therapy was, number one, to help people deal with fear, just fear on its own, fear of heights or whatever, but it was also to teach people to trust, because a lot of people are injured today and have health issues because something's happened to them and they lost the ability to trust other people. So it was a great concept, and it worked really well. This is a traveling group of trapeze. This gentleman, he traveled. I don't know if he's ever gotten one place and stayed there, but when he came to Hippocrates, it's because he was actually traveling the country and exposing people to trapeze therapy. And I just thought it was an ingenious idea.
Well, it was. And, I'm not going to say any of our challenged folks tried it, but a lot of people did, and a lot of people got a great deal of enjoyment out of it. And I don't know whether they looked at it as letting go of their fear as much as they did as an opportunity to do something that they would otherwise never be able to do. I mean, who would have thought that you could take people who hadn't been trained to beyond the flying trapeze and just give them an opportunity to give it a shot. I mean, I thought it was very myself, and it did do some good for some people, and it did help mm-hmm. them fight their battles. And, being in the struggle for your life is a tremendous battle. And just sitting by and not doing anything is some people's choice. And some people choose to fight tooth and nail and say, this isn't going to get me. I'm going to fight this and I'm going to win. And it's amazing when you meet some of these people. And ironically, I don't know why life does this to us, but many times people fight these challenges their whole life. Various challenges, and sometimes they're really bad and sometimes they're not so bad. I don't know. I used to tell people I've been through times in my life when it was bam, bam, bam. I said to somebody one day, I said, in one of my other lives, I think I was Mata Hari or something, and I'm being paid back this time. And I think we do things like, I think sometimes we feel really overwhelmed by what life just brings to us. And having an opportunity to build your courage and let go of your fears, being afraid of something is awful. It's really awful, and it can cripple you. It can really put you in a place where you can't function at all, not just take on this many things, but you cease to live. And
fear, and I think this is for a couple of reasons because of some of the research I'm doing, but fear is actually a more detrimental emotion than anger, providing the anger isn't hatred. Now, hatred is an extremely destructive emotion, but just anger, like you've gotten this diagnosis that you have cancer or something like that, and you get angry and you say, you know, the doctor told you have 6 months to live, and you get angry and you say, no, I don't have 6 months to live. That's a ridiculous prognosis. I'm going to figure out how to rise above this, and I'm not going to give into it. And whether you decide to do chemo or you decide to do more holistic or natural methods or whatever, that mindset will serve you. But if you're fearful, if you go into fear mode because of that diagnosis, it actually impacts the body more detrimentally. It actually weakens the immune system. There's been a lot of studies that have showed this. So people that rail against that type of a disease with going into extreme sports and things like that is actually more beneficial because it's making them face their fears. It's making them, it's kind of bringing them to that where it's not so much that they're like taunting destiny, but that they're allowing themselves to feel a little bit more invincible than they felt while they were having the cancer, or if this is at the onset of finding out they have cancer, it lets them feel that they have a little bit more control over when it's their time. So there's different parts of the psychology that would surface with that. But definitely anger towards your diagnosis, as long as it's focused on overcoming it. That's what happened to me. When I was told in my late 30s that I probably wouldn't make it to 40, that didn't scare me. That pissed me off because although my body felt awful and I felt near death physically, I was very, very weak at that point when I got that prognosis, it angered me that a doctor would actually say that to me. And I'll never forget, when I walked out of the office that day, I got really ticked off. And I said, no way is that going to be my reality. And here it turned out not to be because I started researching and stuff. It pushed me into doing something proactive, and it worked out for me. And I know other people that have similar stories to me. So that it's an interesting point that type of a railing against what they're facing is much better than sitting and succumbing to the fear. The fear is actually much, much more detrimental and could actually increase the illness because it really tears the immune system down.
Well, I think that fear can actually make you ill. Fear all on its own, without any other kind of challenge, fear can actually make you ill. So, I applaud all the people that we read about, the ones that climbed Kilimanjaro and flew a plane for the first time. I read lots of stories that I didn't share, and because they start getting a little repetitious. But the deal is that, you know, in some cases they did it right after their diagnosis and thought that they would, push their luck and try all kinds of things if they were going to die anyway, was the attitude. And then other times, after they went through whatever choice they made to survive the cancer, whether it was medical, whether it was holistic, whether it was a mixture of both, then they decided to just live it up because, you know, life is short. And they wanted to do some of the things that they dreamt about and never dared to do. So it's an amusing thing, the way we all think. It always amazes me. Some people say things to me and I'm like, oh, my God, how did they think of that? Or where did that come from? I never thought of that. So that's why I love talking and interacting with people, because they say things and I think to myself, God, I never even gave that particular idea a thought. So Monday was good, and I think we'll probably have opportunity to talk about that again, because of course illness and challenges is a part of everybody's life, even if it's not them, it's a loved one or somebody. And of course, the older you grow, the more in touch with that kind of reality you become. I did a little assessment the other day and realized that I've lost a lot of my friends that were my age and grew up with me, and they're gone. So you do start thinking about that kind of thing. Now, Tuesday, we talked about, well, the reason I brought it up was because of the waste of money, because here we are crying poverty, and our government is doing a shutdown, which is probably costing us billions of dollars more, but I'm not even going to get into that. But having trials and going through the procedures and rules and regulations of a courtroom trial when somebody is holding the smoking gun and has admitted to what they did, and there's no question that they did what they did. But there's still a trial because it's set up that everybody gets the same rights. And I love that. I love the fact that we all have the same rights. And after the show, I thought to myself, so what if you are mentally incompetent and you're saying, you know, because I thought of other scenarios, and of course I thought of old law and orders and stuff where people have taken the blame for things and said they did it and didn't. And that made me question, you know, some of the other things that we talked about. And I suppose that that is something that happens, and that is something that other people have dealt with, you know, having somebody who's mentally ill or mentally challenged in some way.
Or trying to protect the real individual. Now, although that might be noble on that part, it leaves a criminal out on the street. So if the evidence shows that the person who's confessing couldn't have really done it, they can't just lock somebody up because they say, I did it. They have, you know, if there's no way that they could have, if the evidence shows that they couldn't have been at the place when it happened. The only thing that you said, though, Rini, you just said that if somebody is caught in the act and admits that they did it, I don't believe there's a trial. If somebody pleads guilty, I don't think there is a trial. I think the only time you have a trial is when somebody pleads not guilty or not guilty by reason of insanity, and then you have to prove that the person's insane. But if somebody, because you see that a lot, they say, here, we can, you know, let's not put this through a trial. If you just, you know, and then they try to plea bargain with them, because if they get a guilty plea, then they don't have to have a trial. They don't have to wait and hear what the jury says. And a lot of times, if you remember, like on the Law and Order shows, this is where I get my law education from, if they don't have to wait for the jury answer to come in. If the person will just go ahead and plead guilty and take a plea bargain, they don't even have to wait for the jury verdict to come in. And sometimes they scare them thinking that the jury might be giving them 25 years to life or a death penalty or something, and they're trying to talk the person into a guilty plea, where they admit what they did and take their punishment, and then this way they don't even need the jury. So if somebody pleads guilty, there is no trial. It's only if they're saying they didn't do it for some reason, by reason, or they say that they're not, or they're saying they're not guilty because it was self-defense, or that's not guilty by reason of insanity. They're not even necessarily saying they didn't do it, but what they're saying is that they were justified in doing it for some reason. Okay? But if they just flat out say I'm guilty, there's no trial.
Well, there isn't a trial by jury, but there are court dates. There's a lot of stuff done in a courtroom, even when that happens. A lot of repetitious sitting and waiting with all the people involved sitting and waiting there for it. I know that firsthand. So
gotcha.
You're right that if somebody says that there is not a trial by jury. And
trials. I think people forget that there's such things called bench trials where you're just up in front of the judge and other court people. But you're right. There's no jury there.
Mm-hmm. Still, a lot of people and money and time invested to go through all the red tape. And because I'm a simple person, I believe in keeping things simple. I believe in saving steps. Maybe that's all my years of taking care of too many kids at one time and being a waitress. If you're a waitress or a bartender that wastes time and steps, you're not very good. In order to be good at that job, you have to be able to do two or three things at one time and save as many steps as you can. So when I got caught up in this thing with my grandson and saw all the different steps that were taken, all the back steps that were taken, all the side steps that were taken, and all the time that was wasted, I thought to myself, my good God, no wonder we're broke. No wonder we're broke. It's awful. And I you know, I can't, even if I sat here and gave you points of fact, you know, like days that we would go and I would see 15 lawyers in the room. 15 lawyers.
Yeah.
The judge and his clerk and this one and that one. Like I said the other day, all these people in this courtroom, yes, it's a business. I get that. And yes, these people are working for a living. And I get all that as well. But the time that's wasted, the extra steps that are taken, I believe everybody deserves due diligence. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying it should just be a cut and dried thing because you're talking, in some cases, somebody's life. But on the same token, there's a way to streamline everything. Let's face it. And there's a way.
I absolutely agree with that. I absolutely agree. Well, I told you the one court case I was involved in recently, this went back about a year and a half ago, this one particular judge, this is down in Broward County, and I had attended four different hearings on one particular case where the opposing party was actually being malicious and creating additional problems. So the judge got angry and set a stipulation out ordering this other party to do something, and if they didn't do it, they were going to be held in contempt of court. We go back the next hearing. They refused to do it. Instead of holding them in contempt of court, the judge gave them another chance. Meanwhile, we're doing everything we're being told to do. All right, this went on for four hearings. As of the fourth hearing, this other side still had not complied to two of the orders given from three hearings earlier. You know what this judge did? He gave them another date. So, the incompetency of some of the judges on the bench is surprising to me. He was an older gentleman. And because every time you had to postpone the hearing, it took like 3 or 4 months to get another one, because this went on for about a year and a half, all right? By the time we came to the next hearing, he had forgotten half of what he said, didn't read the notes. A couple of times our attorney reminded him what he said. He had no recollection on some of the orders he gave. He goes, oh, I said that last time. I don't even remember that. He actually said that to us in one of the hearings. So One of the problems where we've crippled ourselves is allowing so much time to go between hearings. Like, you have one little problem in a hearing, bam, you get a postponement, you come back 4 months later, and half the time the judge doesn't even remember what was going on anymore. So we've really crippled ourselves with the way things unfold in the court system now, and that hearings are so spread apart, and the minute you hit a snag, instead of finishing it out that day, no, everybody disperses and reconvenes months later, but you lose something when you keep breaking it up like that.
Mhm. Well, and that is a big part of the problem. But the point that I tried to make on Tuesday, well, what got in my craw, of course, was seeing James Holmes sit there looking like the atypical of somebody who had totally lost their sanity, and realized what he had done and all the witnesses that survived that day when he just came in and just started firing around the room. People who are saying don't do things like that. So for them, the way the law is written, you have to wait for a lawyer to believe that he's crazy. Then she or he puts in a formal judgment about, you know, their sanity, and then there's a hearing about, I mean, it's like, oh my God. It's like the march of the snails. And it makes you wonder when you realize that we're in so, there's so many other things that are going on. I don't know. I just find it to be very frustrating. I am not smart enough, educated enough to be able to tell everybody what they should be doing. But I'd like them to assess what they're doing, because they have the intelligence, they have the education to make better decisions and to clean that up, to make it better, just like our government right now. What the hell? They're all sitting there, they all know what needs to be done, and nobody's doing it.
That's
it's
right.
Frustrating.
That's right.
Is it not? I mean, it's really frustrating. So that's what Tuesday's show was about, and as days go by and as we research that a little bit more, we will probably do another show in regard to the legal system and what is going on. And if anybody has loves to read, years ago I read Fall of Angels, which was about a young attorney who was just starting. It was a fiction, but it was about a young attorney who was starting out. She was all gung-ho and really wanted to make a difference in the world. And she realized it was like she was immersed in a bad drama, because the finagling and the playing and the wheeling and dealing that goes on behind the scenes was overwhelming. And right. I kept thinking to myself, well, I was young, you know, not the tainted soul that I am today, and thought to myself, this, you know, this isn't true. This, they don't do that. You don't make deals out on the golf course, and you don't do this, and you don't sleep with somebody to get them to give your person less time. This was all the stuff that was going on in the books. Now, at 65 years old, I know that book was a lot closer to the truth than I ever wanted to believe when I was in my 20s. So it is what it is, and it is up to the people that are immersed in it to clean it up. And until we do that, we're always going to have problems in that arena, and we're always, always going to be in debt. Wednesday, we talked about kidnappers. And I read excerpts from Elizabeth Smart's story. If you have not had the chance to see her on television or on one of the talk shows, she, for all appearance sakes, a charming, beautiful young woman who's poised and articulate. I thought she was lovely. And I want to applaud the fact that when we talk about survivors, my goodness, I mean, we are talking about a major survivor here, to have all the things happen to her that she did, and to still, I hope, her insides are as beautiful and poised as her outside, because she was lovely, is lovely. And then, of course, we talked about some of the other, through history, kidnappings, and the fact that, very sadly, in a lot of cases, it's the kidnapper is a family member. And it's not always because they love the child so much and they want to take the child and raise them as their own. It's for other motivation that's mean and cruel. And we read about a grandmother who actually kidnapped her own grandchildren and kept them in a basement, and just awful things. So, and of course, on the show, we've done a lot of research about our history and about some of the things that have happened in the past, and some of the stories are horrific. But Elizabeth's story is wonderful, and I have since done a little bit more research on the three ladies that survived the Cleveland fiasco with the man who was found guilty. And now that was a very speedy trial. There was no messing around about that. He was caught in the act. I applaud how quickly that was taken care of. That was a whole different ball game than what we usually come up against. And they seem to be, every now and then I catch a story about one of them, and they seem to be growing and flourishing and getting past their ordeal. But one of the things that I've picked up on is a lot of cases, if there's more than one and there's other somebody to feel like you're not alone, the survival rate or the ability to bring yourself to some semblance of balance seems to be easier when there's more than just one of them. And even in Elizabeth Smart's story, she talked about that man's wife, even though she was abusive to her and treated her like she was her maid, she still had contact with somebody other than this person that was continually abusing her. So,
I also think that in a situation like that, like with the three women, for instance, is that mm-hmm. if you have somebody that really understands intimately what you went through, that you can speak to, you know, it's one thing to speak to somebody who's sympathetic just because they have normal compassion, okay, you know, like a therapist or a police officer or something like that. But when you have somebody else that you know actually went through it with you and they survived also, you gain not only compassion but strength from each other. So, yes, when you have multiple people that succumb to abuse or something like this from the same perpetrator, the different victims can actually give strength to each other that you wouldn't get just from somebody being compassionate or lending you an ear. So that is more of that's more of a strengthening scenario.
Yeah, it's kind of a stabilizer to know that you're not alone. Well, mm-hmm. and we've talked about that before as well, people who feel like they are alone. I know I've read that many, many times in different books and different comments from other people. And I can't remember the story that I read not very long ago, and it was about, you know, you don't have to be alone to feel alone. And
right.
That's a very, very, very true statement. And just because there's somebody with you, and that's probably, well, and I'm quoting other people, that's probably the worst loneliness that there is. But having somebody in a situation where you're kept a captive and not allowed to go into the outside world and stuff like that, just to have somebody else. Well, remember stories that we've seen before of people in prison scenarios? There's old movies, The Birdman of Alcatraz and stuff like that, how he made friends with the birds just to save his sanity. Remember that Burt Lancaster movie years and years ago? Are you old enough to remember that?
No, but I know the story of the Birdman of Alcatraz.
But that's what he did. I mean, he saved his own, because he was in solitary confinement, and he saved his own soul and his own sanity by making friends with these birds. And interaction is imperative to, I think, our mental wellness. So the kidnapping stories were awful. And hopefully that there was an arrest this morning or late last night. There was a child that they did an Amber Alert, a little boy, and they found his babysitter absconding with him and arrested her early this morning.
So, oh, my God.
Yeah. So, you know, things have changed in a lot of ways in regard to that. The Amber Alert, the ladies that I talked about in the very, very beginning of starting my show, A Child is Missing. If you are a relatively new listener, I met these ladies when I was doing the lecture circuit with different places and schools and churches and senior citizen homes I did a few times and stuff like that. And I met these ladies, and none of them have children. They're psychologists and teachers and things like this. And they are the ones who originally set up the Amber Alert. And they have this little tiny office in Fort Lauderdale, and they have the ability to send out messages to landlines. It's been a long time since I've talked to any of them. I don't know if they can do it on cell phones now, but they could send out.
I get alerts. Reenie, I do get alerts on my cell phone. I get Amber Alerts and I get Silver Alerts on my cell phone.
Now that while I'm saying this out loud, I'm thinking to myself, I just got one the other day, so they can do cell phones. And it tells people in a radius of where a child is missing exactly
right.
what he's got. The last time he was seen or she was seen, the color of hair, da-da-da-da. It's wonderful, wonderful. And it is national. And these ladies talk to police departments all the time, and their office is alive. I think they are awesome. And that has certainly helped, I would guess. I don't know that anybody's done any statistics on how much easier it is, but if we think about the stories that I read that were a long time ago, some of those kids were never found and could be. Well, remember the story I read about the woman who's been gone for 18 years?
Yes, yes.
And nobody ever found her? That happened a lot back in the 40s and the 50s. And,
yep.
of course, with our technology today, with the phones and the iPads and all the things that we all complain about but love to have, I think that's made a difference. So I think along with the bad stuff that it brings, like cyberbullying and all those kind of things, and the ability to make a faceless comment, I don't think is good, but I think it does help in other respects. And then, of course, yesterday we did a show in regard to bullying. And, of course, bullying, Shelley and I have found out just through talking that bullying is a big part of everybody's lives, not just the scenario that you see on the news, not just the scenario that you see on the movies where the big guy's picking on the little guy. Not even the stories about finding out that, your 11-year-old child is being ostracized for being gay or different or fat or skinny or ugly or whatever. It's also happening in the workplace, and it also happens in homes. It also happens in relationships, even in churches where you think everybody went to care about each other and love each other and look out for each other, there's even bullying there. And it's connected to almost everything that we talk about in one way or another. We found that out easily, haven't we, Shelley? I mean, it's all it's down at the bottom of the pot is poor behavior, boorish behavior, picking on somebody that's littler than you. It's all about bullying.
That's right. That's right. But, and one of the things which I love that Izzy taught us is that people label a lot of things bullying that are not. Criminal behavior, physical assault, that's not bullying. Bullying is more along the lines of doing something that's mean-spirited, saying something that's mean-spirited. You have a boss at your job that's very disrespectful to you and barks out orders and very unreasonable and things like that. That's bully. That's kind of bully. But you have a boss that comes over and touches you in a way that's inappropriate, or that pushes you or something like that. That's criminal. That's assault. That's not bullying. That's taking it to the next level. You have a kid at school that strikes another child, that's criminal behavior. That rises above bullying. And unfortunately, anytime a person does something, or mainly kids, because I don't know that people recognize bullying behavior when you become an adult, although if that's what it is, it's just transcended youth, okay? But when you have a kid at school that strikes another kid or that pushes them hard enough to make them fall down, not just a little shoulder bump or something, although that's not acceptable either, But when you have a kid that's really shoved into the lockers, touched in any way, now that's not bullying anymore. That's risen to assault, and it should be looked at as a criminal act. And these school officials aren't responding. If it's just bullying, you sit them down, you talk to them, and you get them to understand each other. You don't punish the bully, because now he's just going to be more angry at the guy he's going after. Now he's going to go after him, 200%. You know, and so I like a lot of Izzy's philosophies. They make sense. He's seen in many, many situations where they actually work. But the bottom line is that we call a lot of things bullying that aren't bullying, that transcend that, and the violence puts them into a criminal act.
Okay, so you remember yesterday when we talked about Duval County and the 14-year-old girl who was beaten by another 14-year-old girl. Her head rammed into a stone wall. She suffered a fractured skull. The judge said that she was a nuisance, a danger to all the schools, and deemed her as being uncontrollable, etc., and barred her from all of the schools. And the Duval County school superintendent stepped in, overturned the judge's ruling, and put that child back in school. Now, in the meantime, I found no information about this young woman being charged with battery or anything else. So you're right. Everything that we've talked about with Izzy, we both agree on that totally, that having getting a swirly is one thing, wedgie is one thing, or writing kick me on a piece of paper and sticking it to your butt is another thing. But taking you and whooping the hell out of you is some kind of a crime. And,
right.
Whatever what lawyer wants to term it, I don't know, because they use all different kinds of words. But this young woman, to my knowledge, nothing happened to her. So
yeah, that's astonishing.
Yeah, so because it was looked at as bullying and boorish behavior, and she was told she couldn't go back to school because she's a bad girl, how did she get to school when she should have been put in reform school?
Right. Yeah, no, she should have been incarcerated, whether it was a youth center or an actual jail. That was premeditated. See, the premeditated nature of her action should have come into consideration, because this was something she set up. She asked people to film it. To record on their phones, it doesn't make it any more right if it's done in a moment of passion, but if somebody just loses their temper, it carries a different way of analyzing it than somebody that planned for this and set this kid up. That shows somebody who is much, much more dangerous than somebody who just lost their temper. Because somebody that lost their temper can be railed back and can go through anger classes. But if you have somebody that's premeditated like this, that's like a sociopath. That's a much deeper emotional disorder, and nobody's attending to that. Ban her from school, no, put her back in school. Well, what about attending to the crime she just committed? That is a crime, what she did to this girl.
That's right. That's exactly right. And that's what I don't get. I really, really don't get why nothing was done about that. But I suspect, you know how when something's brought to your attention and it's given a title or a name or an excuse, maybe even, then instead of anybody standing back, which of course I complain about all the time, and looking at the big picture, they're just judging on the challenge of the minute. In other words, okay, the judge did this hearing, barred her from school, that was her punishment. She can't go back to any public school. Why he didn't say at the same time, and you're not going to go to school, you're going to go to this special school. I mean, because I go to drug court with other people who don't have anybody, I've sat in drug court on many occasions. I love the way it's run, and I think that it is amazing, the understanding of the people involved in drug court. I don't know when drug court came to be. For years, I think those kind of hearings were done in an open court. And I know if you're going in for an arraignment in court and you've been picked up on a drug charge, then you go to a regular courtroom. But once you've been, I don't know, I'm searching for words here this morning. Once you've been convicted of having a crime to do with drugs, then you're ordered to a drug court now. And the drug court monitors you. The courtroom is not filled with lawyers. There's probation officers and counselors. A whole different kind of atmosphere. And
right.
When, just like an AA meeting, when somebody goes through 2 months of court, shows up on time, is passing all their you know, drug tests and drops of urine and all that kind of stuff, the judge and everybody in the room applauds them.
Wow. That's amazing.
I know. So why wouldn't we have, because it's just another challenge for somebody to be that mean. I mean, this other 14-year-old girl, the perpetrator, she needs help. And now she's not going to get anything. Now she's just been, because the superintendent said she could go back to school, now she's back in the same public school, according to the report that I read, and now nobody's going to pay any attention to what's going on with her. So they did her, instead of looking like they did her a favor, they did her a major injustice.
Well, sure, they did her a major injustice, and they actually did a trifecta of bad decisions, because number one, they didn't help her. All right, they didn't teach her anything. Number two,
right.
they put the victim in a more vulnerable point, because now they put her back in the same school with the person she just victimized, and she's either more angry at this individual or she feels more untouchable by justice, okay? And they sent out a really, really bad message to the rest of the school, to the rest of the students. So it has a three-way, very, very bad impact, because there was nothing... There was nothing that was handled active or appropriate way. That was absolutely inappropriate to make those decisions, and it was more inappropriate for the superintendent to countermand it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm gonna see if I can do some follow-ups on that. But every time I've tried to do that, I tried to get in touch with Bailey, the young girl further up north, the one that took the stand and got the judge to say that yes, they could keep the after school activities and she could do the Gay Straight Alliance and all that kind of stuff. And I wanted so much to be able to talk to her, but once somebody gets put in the news like that, they're kind of sequestered. You know, you can't really get a hold of them or talk to them. Which I understand and I appreciate, but I would like to be able to follow up a little bit on this case and find out what happens to this young woman. But of course, her privacy will be probably paramount after all the other stuff that they've said about her. And like I said, in the videos that you watch, you don't ever see her face. At least the one I watched, you didn't. But it does make me feel bad to think that she's only 14 years old and somebody with the right decisions could maybe save her, you know, maybe put her in a place where she doesn't need to be so mean. And if she's so mean, why is she so mean? Is somebody else being that mean to her? Is somebody else hurting her so she has the need to hurt somebody else?
Well, see, if she's sociopathic or has some sort of clinical mental disorder like that, that's difficult to deal with. When you have somebody like that, it's almost like they're missing a part of their conscience. But if she's lashing out, like you said, because she's being abused, and she can be helped in directing that differently and maybe having an outlet for what's happening to her, then there's a little bit of hope. But if she's just so sociopathic, a lot of times you get somebody like that, and I don't know that they're rehabilitatable. So it's almost like their mind is missing something that gives them a conscience.
Well, and maybe it's not just about rehabilitation, Shell. Maybe it's about saving her.
Right.
You know, I mean, if you really look into it, maybe. You know, maybe somebody is really, really being awfully mean to this child. And that makes more sense to me. I realize people are born with a missing link. I get that. Or a missing connection. I while on the phone yesterday with somebody that I've grown to care about very deeply, and she's struggling in a relationship like that, and there's really no quick fix, you know, that's the deal. And sometimes I counseled this person, and I've counseled other people in concentrating on yourself, because a lot of when you get so involved in the fact that somebody else has got all these issues, our good friend Anthony Chatham taught me this probably 13, 14 years ago now. He said to me, Renee, this is about you. And I said, please don't lay that on me too. And he smiled at me and he said, some of this. And he said, you're angry about it, you're hurt about it, and you need to let go of it. And I, at first, I wanted to fight him about it. You know, I wanted to say, this has got nothing to do with me. This is because of this, this, and this. Because I know. He said, that did the ball rolling, but, you know, now it's about you. And through the years since that conversation with him, when I've listened closely, I've realized in a lot of cases it's because somebody doesn't let go of something and they put it into the mix and make their own monster. So there were others about that ended very sadly. A 13-year-old boy who took his own life, and the young girl who hung herself after being ridiculed in school because of an attack by four boys that also never any additional help. So We're out of time, but I want to wish everybody a wonderful, wonderful weekend. The weather is a little bit cooler here in South Florida. We're having a great picnic birthday party on Sunday at Quiet Waters for any of those people that are out there that I know to the show, and you're going to be there. I look forward to seeing everybody. And it's my grandson's birthday today, Michael Robert. 19 years old today. I want to shout out a big happy birthday to him. Very, very proud of him and all of the challenges he has overcome. It's also the week of his father's birthday, my second son, and my baby is 40 years old today, or today, not today, on the 16th, but the party is for all three of them, and I look forward to that day with everybody. So everybody have a awesome, awesome weekend. Shelley and I are meeting and shopping for a place to start a detox center. Please remember that we're looking for something. It can be commercial or it can be a very, very large house. We are looking with ourselves and Michael Berganzi, make an awesome threesome. So if there's something that you can think of that you would like to talk to us about, let us know. God bless everybody and have a great day. Bye, Shell. I'll call you in a little bit.
Okay. Bye, Renee. Everyone have a wonderful day and happy birthday, Mikey.
Bye-bye.